Good evening. Oh boy, that's great. It was all the way to the back of the hall. We're going to give you some information about the music you're going to hear, six pieces. And if you haven't looked at your program, that's why you haven't looked at it. Good. That just says carte blanche then. But I'm going to present and talk, Peter and I are going to talk about the music out of order. But that'll work out.
Right. Breaking traditions.
Right. We've had auditions, as we have every year, for two soloists. And this year, we ended up with a wonderful clarinet player, Clifford Tam. He's a student of Joe Bonfiglio. And Christine Hsu is going to be playing the first member of the Rachmaninoff piano concerto. I have this to say about the Debussy. A friend of mine, Richard Stoltzman, recorded the piece quite some time ago. And this is what he said about it. The very first piece of classical music that I fell in love with was when I was in high school, and it was the Debussy Première Rhapsodie. I remember taking it to my teacher, who agreed with me that this was a very beautiful piece, but I wasn't ready to play it. I'm so sad because I love the harmonies and the gorgeous main melody in the clarinet. Later, another clarinet teacher told me that the piece was written as a competition piece, and therefore there were all kinds of technical hurdles in the music that you had to overcome. So for quite a while, I only approached this piece as I got older, and I realized my first impression of the piece, that it was a simply beautiful piece, was the right attitude to take in playing it. It was then, when I started playing the Debussy as a beautiful melody, that I discovered the soul of the piece. The piece is 9 minutes long. It's 9 minutes long, and we've had sufficient rehearsal, and Clifford came in and played it perfectly every time. It was just a wonderful person to work with. He's so confident, and I'm sure you're going to really, really enjoy it. It's a very beautiful piece. But like the Dvorak, which I'll talk about later, this is a lesser piece. Debussy is not known for this piece, except by clarinetists. It's a small piece, and so you go to a symphony orchestra concert, maybe in San Francisco, you probably won't hear this work. It has to be combined with something else, because it's only 9 minutes long. But we've combined it with five other pieces, so the program ends up being the right length. You have something to say about this, don't you?
Just to add to that, the way that this piece came about was that when Fauré was the conductor, director of the Paris Conservatory, he appointed Debussy, who was his protege, to actually write this piece. And he essentially said to Debussy, he said, I want you to make this piece as hard as you can. It is a competition piece. And he essentially wanted this to be so difficult to be played that it would definitely separate the talents from the lesser talents. So Debussy set about that, and he actually did quite a few things in the piece that make it especially difficult. Any clarinetist will tell you that their pinky finger is the weakest finger. In fact, anyone knows this. You don't have to be a musician. But what Debussy does in this piece is he actually uses all seven finger positions of both pinkies in several of the trills that the clarinetist actually plays. And so it sort of becomes a tongue twister, if you will, for the clarinet. And so that, and also there's just a lot of control that the soloist has to have in order to play this. There's a lot of diaphragm, there's a lot of embouchure to be able to get the tonal and expressive control that he So, great piece.
The other thing I might add is that, especially the French, but quite often, a composer will write something for an instrument and piano, and is successful. And the composer, usually, but not always, will then orchestrate the piano part so that now it's played for solo instrument and orchestra. And sometimes it ends up being just that. That's what people know the pieces as, clarinet piece, solo piece, with orchestra. But the original was for piano. And it's interesting, from my standpoint as a composer, to see how he takes the piano part and decides how he's going to parcel out the parts for the rest of the orchestra and what orchestration he's going to use. Is he going to use a full orchestra or a little bit less? Unlike the Dvorak, which is a wind serenade, which all wind players know. If you're a clarinetist or an oboist or a bassoonist or a French hornist, you will know this piece. It's one of the standard pieces for wind ensemble. Chamber music. Therefore, it probably doesn't appear, like the Debussy, on an orchestra program too often. It might be on a chamber music program where there are just small pieces, all, or in other words, maybe four or five, six people playing, or maybe some solos, but not with a full orchestra. So after we play the Moldau, I'll excuse the whole orchestra, and we're going to take a while to reassemble those wind players that are playing so that we can see them, and hopefully it will take out the problem of letting the orchestra look stupid for 25 minutes because they're not playing. So I just send them off stage. Then we have to have a little more time because then they have to bring the piano back on and then put the orchestra back together so we can listen to Christina Schuh. The Dvorak, he wrote this about in the middle of his composing period. And by this time, he had written in all venues, opera, symphonies, songs, all kinds of little and large pieces. The only problem is, he still was poor. He wasn't getting any money, not enough money for his music. So Brahms took pity on him because Brahms thought this was a marvelous composer. So Brahms talked to his publisher and said, publish this man's music. And from then on, it was sort of history because then he could come to America, as he did, and finish the rest of his composing life. The ensemble, without flutes, it seems a little strange for flute players. Why didn't they ask? Because we have to have some high notes. Well, it means the clarinet players and the oboe players are going to have to play something high, maybe a little bit off the instrument. But it works. And the beautiful thing about the Dvorak, it sounds like Dvorak. These wonderful rhythms, these wonderful melodies that come from Czechoslovakia, dance melodies, beautiful songs. Sometimes composers will quote their own from their own music in another piece. This is not true. This music only appears in this form for this ensemble. You're going to say something, right?
Yeah, about the next piece.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
We're making this up as we go, as you can tell. Well, so that actually naturally leads into Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre. Which literally means the dance of death. And French, macabre in French is ghastly or grim or deathly. And the dance of death is essentially a philosophical thought. It's not necessarily, it's not strictly a piece of music, but it's a theme that pervades most of world culture, which has to do with the universality of death. Everyone dies. And it's represented essentially in every cultural form that you have, everything from painting to literature to music. And you find it all over the world, in fact, in celebrations that are as diverse as Saint-Saëns' dance, to the El Dia de Muerte celebrations that happen in all the Hispanic neighborhoods. And these are all based on the idea that you are either celebrating death, or you are making your peace with death, or you are simply acknowledging that death exists. And as there are a number of examples of musical pieces that were written this way. Liszt actually wrote a Dies Irae, which of course in Latin means the day of wrath. And this actually comes from the old Latin mass. There was a Gregorian chant that was associated with the Dies Irae. And of course, this actually finds support in the Bible. You had the Old Testament prophets talking about the day of judgment and the day of the Lord. And Mussorgsky wrote songs and dances of death. Benjamin Britten wrote a scherzo, which he called the Dance of Death. And Shostakovich's Piano Trio No. 2, one of the movements is the Dance with Death. In fact, even today, when you hear someone talk about the inevitability of death and taxes, that is the Dance Macabre. So, what would actually happen is that you would have actors and musicians acting out this entire thing. So you would need appropriately morbid music then to represent the death that you were actually portraying. And it's interesting to see just how pervasive this is, because a great example of this is the sarcophagus of the Habsburg Emperor Charles VI, Austria-Hungary. It's found in the crypt of a church in Vienna. And on the sarcophagus itself is a skull that is wearing the imperial crown of the Holy Roman Empire. And it's not a head that's wearing this crown, it's a skull. And it's interesting to speculate on how Charles VI actually came to decide that that's what he wanted to have on his sarcophagus. Maybe he had no part in that decision, we don't really know. But a lot of the Dance Macabre has to do with the old illustrated sermon texts that we find first around the 14th century. And of course, as you know from history, the 14th century, you had the Hundred Years' War, you had repetitive famine all through Europe, you had the bubonic plague, and these were all viewed as judgments that came from God. And even priests at the time would observe that in the New Testament that you would actually have Paul saying that you must die to self, that death is physical, but your life becomes spiritual. Well, the Dance Macabre actually doesn't deal with death, transfiguration, and rebirth. It just deals with death. So therefore, you have a lot of morbid themes that happen in the music. So what Sanson starts out with is a gonging sound on the low D string of the harp. And the harpist will play this 12 times because she is stroking the hour of midnight. Midnight is when the ghosts come out. The dead dances. And then it immediately goes into a triple meter. It's kind of a waltz, but it's a lot faster than a waltz. And it's too fast to dance to. So even though it's called a dance, it's not really something you can dance to. If you tried to dance to it, you would fall into the grave. And this is exactly what Sanson's intent is to make you feel that you are kind of out of control as you're listening to this piece. And so after the harp opens up with this, the first violin actually states the theme. And what she does is she will play a tritone, which, as many of you may know, is the devil's interval. It is A to E flat. It's a flatted fifth, and it does not resolve in any easy way. And harmonically, it's its own inverse. A to E flat is the same interval as E flat to A. And anytime modern movie music composers want to represent the diabolical, they will always use a tritone. They will always use the Diabolus Musicae. So, in any case, the song then, the piece progresses with the several themes that are woven together in this accidental style. And right at the very, about two-thirds of the way through, the winds actually play the Dies Irae theme itself from the ancient mass. And other things to notice is that there is a xylophone part, which Sanson actually said in his notes, he wanted it to sound like dancing bones. He wanted it to represent the bones of the skeletons as they were dancing. So the final thing that happens, the coda then, is where the oboe actually sounds the crow of the rooster. It is daybreak. It is time for the skeletons to return to the grave. And after that, you're essentially left with this remarkable feeling of, what kind of piece is this? It's very compelling. I love listening to it just to hear all the things that Saint-Saëns does with it. And you kind of have this feeling that you are on this broken tilt-a-whirl at the midway, and things just aren't quite right. But Saint-Saëns resolves it in a very euphonic way. It wraps it up well. You are next, sir. I'm going to do the Rachmaninoff. Okay, so I will mention just one very brief thing about the Rachmaninoff Second Piano Concerto, which is the fact that this piece of music played a critical role in winning a battle of the Cold War. And the story is that in 1958, there was a young pianist by the name of Van Cliburn. Many of you probably know that name. He was 23 at the time. He was a rising star. And he went to Moscow to compete in the Tchaikovsky piano competition against all of the world's rising piano stars. And he played the, actually, I looked this up, it's the Rachmaninoff Third Piano Concerto. Well, it's close enough. And he actually played that piece. And what happened was the applause at the end of the piece with one of the Soviet Union's best orchestras was clocked in at 8 minutes. It was so profound what this Texan pianist had done that even the Russians were blown away. And the organizing committee actually said to the premier Khrushchev, they said, can we give this honor to an American? I mean, this is 1958. We're supposed to be advertising that, you know, Soviet culture is the best that the world has to offer. And Khrushchev actually said that, well, if he's the best, then you better get the award. So they did. It was a major coup. An American going to Russia to compete in a Russian competition, playing Russian music to a Russian audience. And when Van Cliburn returned to the United States, he was on the cover of Time magazine. He received a ticker tape parade down Broadway. It's the only classical musician who has ever received that. And it was considered a major coup to world culture and to the Soviets.
More than I ever knew. The last piece on the program is a work originally written as a commission by the Boston Pops. And it was conducted by John Williams. And it's an unusual piece, because this is the piece that's going to end up with a bagpiper that will start way on the back there. And for those of you that are close to the steps, you may want to put your hands over your ears, because there's only one volume that the bagpipe comes out loud. I thought of maybe, well, maybe we only have three or four bagpipes. No, one. Now, we did this 25 years ago, not here, but in the First Presbyterian Church at 4th and L, with tonight's teacher, 25 years ago, and I asked him, I said, would you like to do this again, Ken Sutherland? I said, I've got a student who plays as well or better than I do. And sure enough, Thursday night's rehearsal, perfecto, no problem. And now, of course, we have a little problem here. We have to come down the stairs. We have to go there. We have to get through a door that someone has to open up for him and go back there. It may be a little diminuendo because it's back there. Then they'll come out here and they'll end up here on the stage. And that's the last piece in the program, because there's nothing I can do after that. It's going to be loud. Okay. The Orkney Wedding. took place on the Isle of Hoy, H-O-Y, up in the Orkneys, right? It's a group of 67 islands north of Scotland, way up by Scapa Flow. If you know your World War I history, you know what Scapa Flow means. So this is a picture postcard of a wedding on Orkney Island of Hoy. The wedding party arrives at the home out of violent weather, and that's the first thing you hear, is terrific rush of violent weather. There follows a processional, sort of a slow, steady march. It sounds a little bit already like a melody that a bagpipe could play. One of the reasons is because of the Scotch snap. What is the Scotch snap? It's nothing you eat, but it's long and short notes that are different than what we usually expect. We usually expect dum, da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. But this is da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. And we hear it in, if a buddy is a buddy coming through the rye, that's the Scotch snap. So you'll hear it in all these Scotch tunes. The band follows a processional, after which the band tunes up, and we hear that, for a wedding dance, which builds, as you might imagine, it can happen at weddings, to an inebriated chorus, which you'll start to hear, Mabel, are they playing the right notes? They don't sound like they're together. This is weird sounding music. Well, this is, in musical terms, inebriation. The guests leave the hall with the echoes of the processional music in their ears, while the sun, personified by the bagpipes, in full splendor, rises over the casements. In live performance, the piper enters in full regalia. We get not only the piper, we get his regalia. And there are more questions about that I won't answer. From behind the audience, he gradually processes on the stage as he plays. This is Nick Thurow, and he's just a love. He's a very nice person, and he plays with extreme authority. And he's played on this stage before with a collection of other pipers, he tells me. I wasn't aware that happened, but that's what that's about. The first piece on the program is the Moldau, and we'll hear Professor Peter
Moldau.
Molding, that's right. I shall mold away. Well, so the Moldau is a great example of how geopolitics affects art and culture. I say this because it was written at a time when nationalist music in Europe was at its peak, which was approximately 1870s, 1880s. And Smetana was Czech. And so the Czechs were always sidelined by whatever larger empire was nearer by. So it was either the Austrians or the Germans or the Hungarians. And so the Moldau then is actually part of a larger work, which we're only playing just a Moldau tonight, but it's part of a larger suite called Mavlast. And this is Czech. In German, you would translate this to Mein Vaterland, and you would translate that into English as my fatherland, obviously. But, of course, if you are Czech, you're going to say it not just as Mavlast, you're going to say it like you mean it. And the way that you mean it is Mavlast. And this, of course, resonates very well with people who are living in Bohemia, which is where Smetana is from. It's where Dvorak is from. And they need something that they can essentially wrap themselves around, because you have armies on every side, and you have a reason, you have a need for a reason for existence, okay? So what happens is German is the language of government in Bohemia, but Czech is the language of the countryside. So Smetana decides that he is going to write a suite of tunes, basically, about the beauties of Bohemia. And the Moldau is a river that flows through Bohemia. And it, again, you have a name collision. The name Moldau is actually German for this river, but the Czech name would be Vltava. It's a completely different name. But Bedřich Smetana calls it Vltava. The unfortunate thing is, when this actually goes to get published, everything is published in German. So, you know, here you are saying, Mavlast, and yet your work is showing up as Mein Vaterland. This is not going to work. So, in any case, the Moldau is designed to sound like a flowing river. And it starts off with a pair of flutes who are mimicking the sound of flowing water. It's a very flowing, lilting melody that happens. The Moldau River itself actually has its headwaters as two springs. And so every Bohemian knows this. They spend all of their time in the forests, and they know the river well. And so, essentially, they're hearing the sounds of the river. And then the river flows through the forest, where we encounter some river nymphs. And Smetana writes a very bucolic middle section for the river nymphs. And of course, if you are saying, Mavlast, you are thinking, nymphs in the river? You are thinking to yourself, you know, this is kind of the fatherland that I think I can support. I really want to get behind this. You know, Mavlast, right? So, in any case, the melody meanders through the forest, and then eventually the melody and the river finally wind up in Prague. Prague is the ancient capital of Bohemia. It was the capital of the Holy Roman Empire. That, by the way, is a triple oxymoron, as I've probably mentioned before. It wasn't holy, it wasn't Roman, and it wasn't an empire. But every Bohemian knows about Prague. Every Bohemian knows about Vltava. So, in any case, it's fun to play. It's a beautiful melody. It's kind of strange because, as I mentioned earlier, all of the musical markings in the score are all written in German. So you find mention of the river nymphs not written in Czech, but actually in German. And the melody itself is very recognizable. La 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 la. And Smetana actually takes this melody, and he starts off with a minor third and a minor sixth. But he switches those around in several places throughout the piece, and he actually plays a major third. And at the very end, he plays a major sixth, which has a very heroic sound to it. It's a very phenolic sound to it. So that's the Moldau. And I think we are just about out of time. So enjoy the concert. Question, Alan. I will bring an answer back to you at our next concert. I can't think of any offhand, but I'm sure that they exist. The powers that be.